I'm Kathy Brockington, president for the 2014-2015 year. Along with several other members of our local chapter, we are proud to offer this opportunity for the voters of the 90th District to get to know more about your candidates. The League mission statement is as follows. The League of Women Voters, a nonpartisan political organization, encourages informed and active participation in government, works to increase understanding of major public policy issues, and influences public policy through education and advocacy. The League is open to all citizens of voting age. Even though it says women voters, we do encourage men to join our League. So please consider it if you're interested. And in keeping with our mission statement, this evening we have invited the Republican candidates who are opposing one another in the August 5th primary for the Michigan 90th House seat. Now, as far as this program is concerned, it is being, use an old word, videotaped, and you can view it in the following places: HCTV on the following channels, Comcast in the Holland area, channels 24, 25, and 26, AT&T Uvers throughout the 90th district, and if you have that choice, select Holland. And the viewing dates and the times will be available after the event if you go to our League website, which is www.lwvholland.org. And if you search for it on Google using that, you'll get, I keep getting a Canadian drugstore website, but nobody else does. So please use the address lwvholland.org and keep trying. And you'll be able to view it online with Vimeo 2 days after the forum at our website, www.lwvholland.org. And then you can also preview what's going to be on your ballot, because the League of Women Voters and the local Holland area have entered information about state and local races at vote411.org. And once on that site, you enter your street address and follow the directions to view your ballot and to read candidates' responses to League questions. There's information about candidates, and there is information about issues, local issues, as well as Prop 1 on the ballot for the state. So please take advantage of the vote411.org to preview your ballot. And nobody sees that except you. Nothing is saved on that website. You can print out, you can mark a pretend ballot, and you can and print it out to take with you to the polls, but nothing is ever saved. So once you're done, you're done. And you may recognize that the information looks similar to MLive, because MLive uses the same software company that the League is using, but our information for the League of Women Voters nationwide is on a different server than MLive's. There's no crisscross of any information, candidates or voters or anything. Okay, we invite audience members to write any questions that you would have for the candidates. Please write them legibly on an index card so that League members can collect them. And the questions are screened for duplication of subject and to make sure that they address issues and not individuals. And now I will turn the podium over to our moderator for the evening, Jan Dahlman, who will read the rules for this event and moderate the discussion.
Good evening. The candidates have received our rules, but for your reading or listening pleasure, I will review those. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to introduce himself, herself. A question and answer period will follow, and each candidate will have 1 minute for a response to the question. Then at the end, each candidate will have 2 minutes for a closing statement. Time limits will be strictly observed. A 30-second card, you want to show that? Will show first. And when the stop card is shown, the candidate must end his or her speech. The order of who speaks first, second, etc., will be determined initially by alpha order of the candidate's last name and will rotate thereafter. You may ask questions via the index cards, as has already been mentioned. I do reserve the right to interrupt if the candidates are straying from the subject or engaging in personal attacks, and we ask you, the audience, to refrain from demonstrating or applauding support of a candidate. And as you have noted, there is no candidate advertising within the room itself. If you are interested in those materials, they will be outside as you exit. Also, would you take a moment to just verify that your cell phone is off? We ask that you keep them off during the presentation. And as already noted, we are televised, so you will be able to follow the forum at a later date. Great. Thank you for your questions. This forum is really about the candidates and answering your interests, so we appreciate your questions. So, as indicated, we will begin with Ms. Garcia, and she will have 2 minutes to introduce herself.
Sure. My name is Daniela Garcia, and I was born and raised here in Holland, Michigan, where I currently reside. My parents, many of you may know, were educators in the Holland Public Schools system, my father being the former superintendent and my mother a 30-year classroom veteran, so long history here in this community. I graduated from high school, West Ottawa High School, went to the University of Michigan for my bachelor's degree, and I also hold a master's in education, administration, and public policy. I have over a decade of public policy experience, having worked at the federal and at the state level in my positions, my former positions and my current one. I currently work for Spectrum Health. And because of my experience in public policy and the various issues facing our state at the national and at the state level, I will be able to hit the ground running on day one when elected. This is something that is essential when we live in a term-limited environment and we need individuals who understand the legislative process. So that is a benefit that I will bring to office. I also just wanted to mention that I have several endorsements, more from individuals in our community than from organizations, and those are available on my website, but have been very privileged to receive the endorsement of former Congressman Pete Hoekstra, Representative Joe Hovman, the current seat holder, as well as other numerous individuals. So with that, thank you for having us this evening. I appreciate it.
Mr. Harmson.
I just want to thank everybody for coming out tonight and also thank the League of Women Voters for putting this on. This is a great chance for us to get our messages out. My name is Bob Harmson, and I am a graduate of West Ottawa High School. I then went on to Michigan Technological University, where I got a degree in civil engineering, and I specialized in structural engineering. After college, I came back and started working with my parents in their family business, Harmson Construction of Zealand. We're a steel and precast erection company. And I've been there for 27 years, and for the last 16 years of that, I've been an owner of the business. So I've got a little business experience, and I've got a lot of leadership experience in the community, running construction projects and working with team members. When I take office, or if I take office, if I am elected, my first three priorities would be to control the budget, control spending, to improve our educational system, and to reduce government regulation. Now, by controlling spending, we need to prioritize what we are spending our money on in needs and wants. We need to fund those programs that we need, our police, our fire, our schools, our infrastructure. Our wants, then, those are something that we fund only after that we've funded properly our needs. When it comes to education, right now we're pretty much at the state level with our education and their control of it. We're moving towards the federal level with Common Core. I want to move back the other way. I want to get it back to the local level, get it back to the school districts, let them set the curriculum, get it back to the teachers, let the teachers have more control in the classroom. And then finally, government regulation. We need to make a system that's common, that's easy to understand, and makes common sense. We need to, most businesses want to follow the rules if they can understand the rules, and that's an important part. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hobman.
Well, good evening. My name is Jeff Hobman. I grew up in the area. I grew up in Blendon Township, actually, on a small dairy farm. Spent a lot of time there with my parents and my grandparents. I learned a lot from them working, and they've really been a blessing to me, and I hope to take some of the lessons I've learned there forward with me. After that, I earned a degree from Grand Valley State University and the University of Michigan Law School. I am married. I'm married to my beautiful wife, Joanna, who's here. She's a physician in Zeeland, and she works there a couple of days a week. We have three beautiful children. I'm committed also to openness and transparency in government. On my website, I've set forth what I believe, the philosophy that governs how I'll make decisions. Government shouldn't be a game of hide the ball. I'll explain to you why I voted the way I voted on whatever particular bill comes before me. And I encourage you to interact with me. I'd be more than happy to explain why I believe something. And if you can come with good reasons why I should change my mind, I'll do that. But I'm running to represent you, the real people of this district, and I thank you very much for your time and attention. Take a look at our website. It's www.votehobman.com, and I ask for your vote on August 8th.
Thank you. Mr. Kroll.
Well, thank you for coming out, and it's good to be here to get the message out. My name is David Kroll, and I've been blessed to grow up in the Zeeland area my whole life, and from there going on to Zeeland High School, where I graduated in 01. And then I went on to Baker College, where I would get a culinary arts degree. While up there, I would also obtain a couple of rental properties, so I do have some business experience, as well as being entrusted to manage some properties and finances with some people. I've been having work experience as far as blueberry picking, as far as working in a hatchery, as far as working at a retirement home, as far as working at general factories. I also have experience as a truck driver. I have a CDL Class A license, and so I know how bad the roads are, and that is one thing I would like to be able to fix if elected to go to Lansing. Between 2009 and 2011, I did some research and some writing. I believe that we have three freedoms: political, religious, and economic, and I am the author of Capitalism Revisited. And hopefully in the next couple of years, I'd be writing two more books on that. I've also been a precinct delegate for 4 years and been volunteering for the Republican Party for the last five. And the reason why I want to run is not just because it's an open seat, but I believe that if you want done something right, you have to do it yourself. I also believe that we need to have character. We need to reconnect between the people and the representatives going to Lansing. And so that is why I'm running, and thank you for having us here.
Thank you. So we begin with the first question, and each of you has an opportunity to answer it. After Daniela asks or responds, then Bob, you can go, and so forth. And then for the second question, Bob, you will be first, and we'll rotate that way. All right? Mm-hmm. So the first question is, what committees would you like to serve on, and how do you feel your service there would benefit our community and the state?
I appreciate that question. There are several committees, as you all know, at the House of Representatives in Lansing. I have significant experience in both education and health care, and those are two of the three largest budget items at the state level. As such, I would appreciate the opportunity to serve on the Education Committee and or the Appropriations Committee, specifically the subcommittees on community health and K-12 or higher education.
If elected, I would probably like to get on the transportation committee. I am an engineer and have quite a bit of background in construction and that, so I think I can do quite a bit for pushing our roads forward, redeveloping some of the strategies that we use, and moving that forward. Regulation reform is another one that I'm heavily involved in, I would really like to get into to simplify our regulatory system. And then corrections is the other one, because that's, as Danielle said, we do spend a fair amount of money in that area, and that's one of those things that I think needs some significant reform in the future.
Appropriations, higher education, agriculture. Although the exact committees that I serve on, I don't think would be the most important thing. As I said, I set forth on the website the philosophy that will underlie the decision-making, And that will be the case no matter which committees I can serve on.
I would do appropriation because we need to spend our money wiser and get rid of some wasteful spending. And I believe there's some reform that we can do, like the prevailing wage law. We can do away with that, the film industry, and reform the Century 21. Education as well, because I believe we really need to focus on a vocational education and get our children ready to go into the workforce, become job creators, and not employees just only. And I'm kind of torn between regulation, correction, or transportation. I might lean more into transportation, but, you know, I'd probably pick one over those three so I'm not too burdened with the other ones. So.
Thank you. Question number two, we start with Bob. Where do you stand on the state film incentive? Senator Representative Bill Huizinga wrote it, and it has helped young filmmakers stay local. So the question, where do you stand on the state film incentive?
Originally, when it came out, I was in favor of it. I thought it was a good idea to attract people to Michigan, to get businesses into Michigan. But what I've been seeing and the data that's been coming out from that, it does not look like it's been a very good investment. We're actually pumping quite a bit of money into it, and the return on that does not seem to be coming back to the state, which was the initial idea behind it. So if I was elected, that's something I would definitely look at getting rid of.
I would not be in support of that type of incentive. Granted, there will be a cluster of activity around where the film money is given, but you have to look at where that money was taken away from. I think it's sort of what you call a broken window fallacy. So I would not support it.
I am not for it, and like I've been saying before, too, I mean, that's dollars that we could use to be spending on fixing the roads. You know, instead of trying to raise taxes to fix the roads, we can take money from that and fix the roads.
The state film incentive, I agree, it was in principle a good idea to attract some business into our communities. That funding has slowly decreased over time, and it is something that I would be open to eliminating. The current legislature has an individual who's been championing that incentive, and he is term limited, and so I think that discussion will happen in the next session.
Thank you. Never-ending special state aid for Detroit, decade after decade. How do we ensure this money is not misused and wasted? We start with Jeff.
Well, some of that's going to be determined by the current legislature. There is a settlement of the Detroit bankruptcy that's winding its way through the bankruptcy courts and being voted on by the pensioner. There is some oversight built into that package. But as for the future, we need to make sure that you can't take money away from taxpayers to fund a pension system when there's assets sufficient in a bankruptcy situation to actually fully fund those pension plans. That's just going to set a precedent for that to happen in municipality after municipality without actual reform to the pension system, either some deadline to when the pension payouts end or, you know, closing the system to not taking on new members. So I don't know that you can do anything about what's happened in the past, but we have to look at where we can go in the future.
I would say if we're going to give them any money, it should go directly towards their debt, and then we should cut off all funds and be supportive of electing council members in the Detroit area that will be fiscal conservative. That way we don't have to worry about deficit spending and have to consider bailing them out. And that's what I would look into, and that way we can at least solve that issue, because as long as they're going to do deficit spending, they're going to continue raising their debt. And if they're going to continue to raise their debt, we're going to probably continue to bail them out. So we got to stop them, and we got to stop them now.
Thank you for the question on Detroit. Detroit, obviously, is our largest city in the state of Michigan, and Detroit is Michigan, and Michigan is Detroit. It is the responsibility of the state and of the legislature to ensure the health of our cities and our townships, and that is what the legislature did in enacting some assistance to Detroit. If we were in trouble here in Ottawa County, in Holland, Zeeland, or Hudsonville, I would hope that there would be some assistance that would come our way with some oversight and some transparency. The City Council, This is 60 years in the making, this problem, and there is oversight to ensure that this does not happen again, and that was put into effect through the legislature's proposal and now package.
As far as the Detroit bailout, I was not in favor of it. I have not been in favor of a lot of the spending that we've been sending to Detroit over the years. But as has been mentioned before, Detroit is a popular city, and it is a black eye on Michigan, so something had to be done about it. Now, hopefully this one-time payment will take care of the situation, and the oversight will actually be able to enforce that. I have my doubts about that. I think Detroit will fall back into the same boat it is. And I think as a state and as a legislature, we're going to have to take the hard line and say we're not going to do it again. And we're going to have to let Detroit know that. Flint is in the same boat right now. Jackson, I've heard, is very close, Benton Harbor. And there's a lot of school districts that are following up behind it. So if we don't take that line now and say we're not doing it again, we're going to continue to bail out everybody, unfortunately.
This question is for David initially. I've heard our candidate, one candidate, has an out-of-state organization putting in a fair amount of money into his campaign. Can you give us an idea of how much money you have received or expect to receive from out-of-state organizations, and what percentage of your overall spending will it represent?
I have received $0 from out-of-state, $0 from out-of-district. I would say out of the amount of money that I've spent, less than 5% probably has come from donors. I am very proud of the fact that everything I'm spending, knowing that it is a low budget, is coming from my hard-earned dollars. So.
Thank you for the question. No percentage, zero money has been put into my campaign from out-of-state organizations. And there is no plan to have their assistance from out-of-state organizations. This is a local race.
I have not received any money from out-of-state either, and have no plans of doing so. I am also very proud of the fact that I've only accepted one PAC contribution from the Associated Builders and Contractors, which is an organization I've been a member of for 20 years. My father was a past president of it, and my grandfather was a member, so their beliefs are very well held with me. I'm not accepting other PAC donations. I think some of the opponents have done that, and I'm kind of curious, who are you beholden to in the future when you're accepting special interest money?
Zero and zero. And like Dave, I'm by far the largest single contributor to my campaign, but all of my other money has been raised from not PACs, just regular individuals within the 90th district.
This question begins with you, Daniela.
Okay.
What is your position on oversight of charter schools regarding students' academic progress? Should underperforming schools be closed?
I think that's the beauty of charter schools. I support all types of schooling for whatever choice that parents make, whether that is homeschool, charter school, public school. Charter schools are unique in that they have bodies that oversee their program and their schools, and at any given point they are subject to that oversight, transparency, and are able to shut down their schools.
Oversight of the public school system, at least, is a very important part at the state level right now, and I think it would continue to do so even if we go back to local control, because I think there still needs to be an oversight to make sure that schools are performing up to par. If the schools have been given warning and are not bringing their curriculum up to par and their students are not becoming up to par, and that their debt is their deficit spending continually, yes, then public schools should be shut down.
Yeah, it would be a possibility in the correct circumstances if a school district is absolutely not performing and finances are a mess, it would be possible to shut down, but it shouldn't be something that is at all done rashly.
Like Danielle, I'm in favor of all forms of education. They all have their perks, and I think when it comes to the schools that are failing, we should look into exactly why are they failing, and is there something outside of financial giving that we can do to help them succeed? And if not, then let's help these kids by getting them into a different form of a school system, whether it be a different public school or charter school or maybe training to get them into homeschooling or even using technology to do self-independent schooling at home.
We begin this question with you, Bob. Mm-hmm. Discuss your support or lack thereof for Common Core standards and explain what alternatives you see for them if you do not support.
I do not support Common Core. Common Core is, for the most part, a takeover by the federal government of our school system. Basically, they're starting with funding dollars and they're pushing it in, and then eventually the testing and the standardized testing that's given is going to have to reflect Common Core. If you don't pass their standards, you're not going to get the money. So schools are going to be forced to do that. So that's why I want to move away from Common Core, move away from state-sponsored schooling as well, and move back to the local level so that we can control our schools in a smaller, more local, and more area-orientated system.
I don't support Common Core standards. Our federal government is a government of limited and enumerated powers. The power over education simply is not one of them. Plus, the idea that you could centrally plan one common curriculum for 400 million people in 50 states and tens of thousands of schools seems wrong-headed. We have the ability to make a curriculum here. There are wonderful universities in this state, wonderful teachers, parents who care about their children. They can write their own standards, their own curriculum in district. And incidentally, many of those curriculums may look a lot alike if they're a good idea, but it's something that definitely can be done locally, and the federal government has no authority whatsoever to do it.
I am against Common Core, and I believe, like Jeff was kind of saying, I think each school district should be able to come up with their own curriculum and create competition. Our founding fathers were graduating from universities at the age of 16 and 17. They had a far more diverse and complex education than we do now, and I think we need to start challenging our kids more, be willing to push them a little bit, and give them the competing edge when it comes from district to district.
Let's be clear. Common Core is not a federal mandate. It is a grassroots program that the Governor's Association, who typically set forth the any innovation that any state is going to take on for a number of matters. This is something that was created with educators, with parents, with community leaders, and again, through our Governor's Association. Any profession, including my own, if you're a teacher, if you are in the construction business, there are standards. Our students need baseline standards, and this is only in two subjects, math and English, and it does not dictate how teachers teach our students. And every educator that I've talked to has supported them.
This starts with you, Jeff. Your thoughts about prison reform, sentencing mandates, especially for minors.
I'm not a huge fan of the sentencing guidelines. I think there should be some discretion in sentencing. That's one of the reasons why you have the judge and you have the trial and you have the finding of facts. So I'd be supportive. There has been some positive movements in correction and prison reform in this state, and I'd like to continue that where it is where it's appropriate.
I also think there's been some positive movement towards being more fair depending on the age of the child and also the type of crime. I think if any were to find themselves into jail, I think we should also be looking into reform that as far as how we can get them out, or once they're out, they stay out. I think that would be the key when it comes to the corrections.
Sound like a broken record. Yes, there are. There have been many efforts to reform our corrections system, especially here in Michigan, through a lot of the hard work of our current representative, Joe Hoffman. You know, when dealing with minors, obviously it's a very unique situation and needs to be dealt with care, and not forget the human side of those children and minors.
I think we do need to allow the judges a little more flexibility when it comes to sentencing so that they can sentence to the crime that was committed and allow them that leeway. And prison reform, there has been some work done. There's a lot more that needs to be done, though. We're nowhere near where we should be yet. We've got too many people coming out of prison who do not have educations, who cannot go out and hold a job, and end up back in prison. That we need to stop. So we need to get a lot farther along with our reforms.
Dave, this question is initially for you. Would you vote to decriminalize marijuana on a statewide ballot? Why or why not?
I would vote to keep it illegal. As far as, I won't get into the medical issue because that wasn't part of the question, but I would just keep it illegal because I believe it's a gateway drug for everything else. And also, just like alcohol, if you have a little too much, it becomes addicting. And we have enough problems as it is when it comes to drug use, so I would keep it illegal.
I, too, would not support the legalization of marijuana. However, there is a grand experiment in the state of Colorado, so how their law will affect their state, I think, will set an example for the rest of the states. But at this time, I would not support that.
I would not support the legalization of marijuana either. I think there are too many abuses and too many problems that will come as a result of it. I've just read a report not too long ago that in Colorado, the number of cases of people driving under the influence of marijuana have skyrocketed. So we have enough problem with alcohol right now and drunk driving. I don't think we need to add anything else to the mix.
That wouldn't be a priority for me. I wouldn't push it, and I wouldn't support it in the state legislature. If it were to come forward on a ballot proposal, I think we'd want to look at the results in other states like Colorado and other places, and then you could determine how you wanted to vote on that ballot proposal. But no, that's not something that I would be supporting at this time.
We start with you again, Daniela.
Okay.
Your thoughts about oversight and accountability for homeschool children, testing and reporting to the state, et cetera.
Homeschooling is something that's very unique, and there is a growing number of families in our state and in our country who homeschool. There is a significant amount of resources available to those families who decide to homeschool currently. In terms of reporting to the state, that is a conversation that I have not engaged in, but I know there's hesitation from those families. Making sure that they have the resources available to them to appropriately educate their children in the environment that they see fit is what I would support.
I am a supporter of homeschools. I think they have a great benefit in a lot of rural communities, and I think they've been utilized very well. I do think, though, we do need some oversight in that area to make sure that kids that are being educated, that they are meeting the criteria, and that we are properly educating these children.
Homeschooling is a tremendous blessing. I fully support parents who choose to do that, and I wouldn't support any additional state mandates upon them.
I'm for homeschooling, and I don't believe we should be increasing any mandates or any kind of testing. I know numerous amount of children have been homeschooled, and they are a lot better off than public school, so I think the state ought to look into how they are being taught and implement that into the public school, because homeschooling definitely has been a blessing. It continue will be a blessing, and the state should leave it alone.
Bob, this question is for you. What solutions would you offer to address the immigration issue specific to the state of Michigan?
That has become a hot button issue all of a sudden, hasn't it? A lot of it is a federal issue, so you know, from the state standpoint, there's not as much we can do. One thing, though, I have talked about is we need to make sure that if people are here illegal, we're not getting them a driver's license, we're not letting them vote, we're not letting them use our educational system and health systems so that we can control that illegal flow in the state of Michigan.
As Bob said, immigration is primarily a federal issue. We don't share a border with or a land border with any foreign countries, so there's not a lot to do. And even if we did, there isn't a lot you can do on the state level about that. The issue immigration, I think you have to ask, is immigration market-based or is it based on some sort of government manipulation of the market? If people are moving to freely associate with others to provide some service or need or supply some product that's wanted in the area, that's a good thing. Immigration is a wonderful blessing. But if it's based on government benefits and social welfare things, then perhaps that would be bad for the system. So looking at those benefits and that aspect of it is probably the way that we could address that in a state level.
Well, like Bob and Jeff said, it is something that needs to be spearheaded on the federal level. I would say, you know, if I was running for bill seat, You know, we should be looking into building that wall. But the state does have its own laws that should be enforcing. And when it comes to education and health, there's a lot of money being used there. And we should be looking into how are we allowing them to continue to stay here and see what we can do in terms of do we send them back or do we put them back in line. I think, you know, even though they have been a burden on society, it's something we shouldn't just keep turning a blind eye. So I would say that we should be looking into enforcing our current laws and making sure we don't give them any more of a foot into the door. So.
This question starts with Jeff.
Danielle.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's okay. No problem. It must be difficult to keep track. Immigration is largely a federal issue, and it is my hope that our federal legislature, the Senate and the House, can come to a resolution, because this is a very difficult issue with many different factors to consider. At the state level, I think there are a couple of positive things that we can do that go along with what the governor hopes to do, is to reinforce those students who are here through the legal process studying at our universities to ensure that there's a mechanism for them to be able to stay here and help fill those gaps in employment that we will have from retiring engineers, teachers, doctors. And so there is a positive outlook in some of the immigration issues, and it's not all negative, although I do hope that there is some resolution at the federal level.
Question 11 goes to Jeff. I'm concerned about the proliferation of leases granted for fracking for natural gas in state public lands, including sensitive nature areas. What is your position on fracking?
Fracking, I think with any other question you have to ask, are we respecting private property rights? So when we're just talking about state-owned land, it's a little bit of a different question. I don't have the science background to be able to tell you all the ins and outs of fracking and whether that's a safe thing or not. But what we really need to ask is, are we respecting private property rights? As long as if you're harming somebody else's property, as long as whoever is engaging in that activity is liable to pay for those damages, then I'm in support of people being able to use their own resources. And so to the extent the state owns these properties, you know, perhaps they should sell them. And if there's a high enough rate, if people want to frack at them at enough level, they'd have to bid for that.
I am for fracking, and similar to what Jeff was saying, if you got like 40 acres of land and you can use 20 of it to do some fracking and utilize that and start competing in the market, then you should be allowed to do that and follow the regulations that are already put in place by the EPA and other things. And we should really look into other natural resources to be energy independent, and we can be able to maybe generate some additional revenue that way and definitely create a lot of jobs. So I'd be for fracking.
Fracking has been occurring in the state of Michigan for at least a couple of decades now, and as long as it's done safely and appropriately in the mechanisms in place to ensure that that happens, that it is safe for the environment, for individuals, then I support it.
For the most part, fracking has been a very safe method of getting out natural gas and oil out of much deeper areas than we were able to go before. The technology is evolving, it's changing, and we're adapting to that as it goes along. And we need to keep studying that and controlling that. The only area that I've ever really been concerned about doing too much drilling, either for oil or fracking or anything else, is in the Great Lakes, so that we preserve our lakes and make sure that nothing is polluted in those.
Question 12. Auto insurance in Michigan. This goes to you, Dave. Auto insurance in Michigan, MCMI catastrophic insurance costs. No limits currently. Runaway increases. Any ideas for cost control?
Honestly, I don't have any ideas off the top of my head. If you've been following my campaign, that hasn't really been one of the things I would be willing, or it's something I'm willing to address. but it's something that hasn't been a priority in which I'm spearheading my campaign. So to actually have an answer off the top of my head on how to fix that, I honestly do not at this time. But I'm also willing to be open to ideas, not only from within this room, but from those who I've been knocking on doors and other representatives, too, as to who may have some experience in that field.
The auto no-fault law in Michigan is something to be concerned with, both as a consumer of auto insurance and a consumer of health care. There are mechanisms to make sure that premiums go down and the health and safety of patients and their families to make sure that they're taken care of occurs. A few items, you know, creating a fraud and abuse mechanism to make sure that there is a lowering of fraud and abuse in that current system, providing a reasonable cap for the benefit is also a possibility, and making sure that there's some transparency in the information through the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association is also very important.
The Catastrophic Claims Division definitely needs oversight. We need a lot more people looking into that situation. They're setting the price, and we're really not knowing where they're coming from. The unlimited cap on medical benefits is something that I think we should remove, too. It should be then an individual's choice where they want to cap their own where they want to cap their requirements. But the actual no-fault system that we have has been kind of a blessing in the state of Michigan from the standpoint of if you ever go to Chicago or anywhere else and you're involved in an automobile accident, it results in a lawsuit. So this way your auto insurance is taking care of it, and it does remove a lot of the hassle from the system.
Thank you. Dave actually made a very good point. You have to know what you know, and you also have to know what you don't know. So one of the blessings of interacting with people is that you can take good ideas from your constituents, and we don't all know the same thing, so you can learn from them as well. I think the Michigan Catastrophic Claims is an entity of state law. It's not necessarily a creation of the insurance market. As such, there is absolutely no transparency there, and this is the cause of expanding costs. I would, again, remove the unlimited benefits. I think we need to let people of their own free will decide what the level of insurance they want to carry would be. And I think when we open that up and we have some transparency in pricing, you know, costs will come down.
This next question, we start with Daniela again. Since Sandy Hook, there has been an average of one school shooting per school week. How would you propose to protect our school children from gun violence?
I appreciate that question, and the phenomena that we're seeing across the country is very concerning and troubling, especially when it involves our students and our young children. You know, I think the bigger issue here is mental health and providing services and appropriate programs in our communities at the local level and at the state level to ensure that individuals are receiving some assistance, because oftentimes we find after an event happens that there were some mental health concerns. So that is very important.
A lot of our local schools have deputies assigned to them right now, at least the high schools do, and as we can see, that's really helped a lot in the violence situation, at least in our area. We haven't had any major concerns in the state of Michigan in a while now, so that system seems to be helping. I think as a state, we need to make sure that we're getting resources to the schools so that they can provide that support. But then also, the mental health issue is huge in the state. We basically kicked everybody else out of the mental hospitals years ago, stopped funding them. And now we're running into this situation where we have people on the streets that maybe shouldn't be on the streets. So I think that's something we really need to look at.
I think as a culture, we need to embrace life. We need to eschew violence in whatever form it takes and in all phases. So we need to embrace a culture of life as a people. Also, I think this can be done locally. I think the individual schools can determine how to make their schools safe. Generally, I wouldn't put the problem on guns per se. I think maybe even ending things like gun-free school zones and having deputies, as Bob had alluded, in schools may be a way forward. But we need to embrace life and step away from violence.
As Jeff and Bob did say, there are deputies, and just remembering my high school years, I remember seeing one practically every day. I would actually encourage and see if there would be any retired people from the Army or from the police department and see if you can get like an extra officer or retired veteran in there. Because if one's on one side, you have the other side that's unguarded. I'd also consider looking into the senior class, maybe taking self-defense class. And I think if the students there are learning self-defense, they can be able to defend themselves if something were to happen. And I think there could be a couple other solutions too. So.
Question 14. Our county clerk recently retired, and he was a model public servant and very accessible. How will you make yourself accessible, Mr. Harmson?
I think that's an extremely important job of a state representative because we represent the entire district, not just the few Republicans that come out and vote for us, but everybody in the district. So first thing, I mean, any of us would have an office in Lansing. We would have a phone number. We would have an email. I have a personal home phone. I have a personal email, and I would set up office hours to make sure that if anybody ever wanted to contact me, I would get a hold of them. I had an individual contact me last night looking at some issues, wanting to talk to me because our current state representative blew him off and wouldn't talk to him. So I think that's a mistake in the job of a representative. Your job is to represent the people, and that's what we need to be here for.
I'll answer the phone. I mean, I'll actually answer the phone when you call. I answer the phone when my clients call me now. They've been very pleased with how I respond to them. I'll also tell you why I'm voting the way I'm voting on particular bills. As I said before, government shouldn't be a game of hide the ball. I'll tell you what I think and what I believe and encourage you to do the same with me. I'll have office hours in the district. I'll hold town hall meetings. And they said I'll explain my votes and I'll be available to you. Send me a text message. I'll write you back. So plan to be there.
I believe Dave Ageman has done something good. And a lot of times just before he would vote, he would actually post on Facebook what he'll be voting on and why he's voting the way he is. So that's something I would do. I would also be making sure that I can, I'm the only candidate that has pledged to have one town hall meeting each month in each six areas of this district. And so each area would have me twice, but you're free and welcome to go from Holland to Hudsonville. I'm also the only candidate that has gone door to door asking people to sign a petition so I can get on the ballot. I'm also willing to donate a certain amount of my salary if I'm not able to lower it. And I think as far as church goes, which I could probably say in my conclusion about my serving, but I believe it's very important to make sure that everyone has their voice and that you respond to them as quickly as possible and you be transparent and there will be no blowing off. And even if...
Thank you for the question. Constituent service is the number one priority of any state representative, and being accessible through all of the mechanisms that the other candidates have mentioned are very important. Participating in meetings with superintendents, with agriculture industry, with healthcare industry is also very important to me. You did mention the former county clerk. I would congratulate him in his retirement, and we do have a wonderful replacement in Justin Robach. So I wish good luck to Dan.
We start now with Jeff. I'm assuming each of the candidates would identify themselves as fiscally conservative. Given that, I'd like each one of you to identify a few areas of the budget you would intend to cut, if any, and indicate specifically what programs and groups would be affected by these cuts.
Things like the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and I think actually a large number of groups would benefit. I've told the story a couple of times about client, friend, whatever, quit his job. He was working nights, you know, he wasn't seeing his kids. He quit his job at own great personal risk to himself. Started his own business, actually in the back of my parents' house. He employs 20 people now. Never got a dime from the MEDC, but they take his money and they regulate him. That money should be left in the hands of the people and they can use it. So to the extent we get rid of these economic development corporations that only benefit insiders, And the bureaucrats and administrators that fund the money, I think, will all be better off.
Like I said before, you have the film industry subsidies that could easily go away or can go to funding roads or something else. You have the Century 21 program. We can reform that so that we could either make sure that the corporations that are promising X amount of jobs provided, or we just don't spend that money. You have to look at the government agency payroll. You know, why should we be paying them about $5, $10 more an hour? Why can't we pay them private sector? And like I said in the last question, you know, I would like to have my salary reduced, and if I'm not able to, I'd be donated. I think all politicians should get paid less, which is why I'm for part-time legislation. I also believe in the contribution benefit plans. We can change that up so that we spend less, and in the long run, if we can pay off our debt, that's less money we're spending on interest as well.
Thank you for that question. The state's budget, it's a little bit of a misnomer to think that it's a budget of $52 billion that you can cut in half on day one. Only $10 billion of that funding is actually from general fund dollars and can be spent on various programs that benefit our communities and our citizens. As I alluded to before, there are three large budget items currently: education, healthcare, corrections. I think the key to finding savings is oversight and transparency so that we know what we're spending our dollars on. And I am sure that there are programs that can be cut. The legislature has done a very good job of ensuring oversight and cutting programs that, are not working. So I would continue that effort.
As far as cutting programs, I mean, we need to start right at the top, and we need to look through program by program to make sure that it's effective, that it's actually not wasting money, and that it's not being duplicated between the county, the state, or the federal level. Specific programs that I would look at cutting is the film program, of course, prevailing wage for construction workers on highway projects and state projects. We're spending an extra $250 million a year on that. It's a minimum wage for construction workers. It starts around $20 an hour and goes to $70 an hour. That's a lot of savings we can see right there. Trying to think of another one off the top of my head, and I lost it, so I guess that's it.
This question is for Dave. Do you think that the local funding plan associated with Proposal 1 will work?
I think, I guess it depends on which way you're defining will work. I think it will work in terms of economic prosperity on a small scale, if you're not taxing business properties. But I don't exactly mean by work if it will work in terms of will it balance or keep the surplus going in the budget or not. I don't know, but I think I'm in favor of it. I think it'll help the businesses out, and I think it will do some good. So
I support Proposal 1. It is a business tax that stifles innovation and growth, and I believe it will work if the voters understand the issue and are able to understand that it is not a personal property tax on one's person or properties, but it's actually a business tax. So as long as the voters vote yes, then it should work.
As a business owner, I am in 100% in favor of getting rid of the personal property tax. It is a job-killing tax. You are taxed on every piece of furniture you have, every piece of equipment you buy. That is based on the original value of it, not a depreciated value. And sales tax is marked on top of that, so you pay tax on tax. It kills jobs, and it kills innovation in business, and it kills people promoting new ideas and new equipment. It is a revenue-neutral system, so that the local agencies and the local governments will still receive their funding. They will actually do a better job of getting funding because it will be a constant even flow for them, whereas now with the personal property tax, it comes and goes. Whether there is businesses go out, that property tax then the personal property tax then leaves. On the construction side, people move their equipment from one spot to another so that we can hide it, basically, so that they're not paying in the high districts.
I think at least I'm presuming what they mean by work is that it will maintain funding level for local government agencies. I don't know if it'll work there. I do know that the personal property tax or business property tax is horrible. That should definitely go. Whether Proposal 1 will meet that goal or not, I'm not sure, but we definitely need to get rid of the personal property tax.
Daniela, this question is specifically to you since you have been endorsed by Joe Haveman. However, I would ask that each of you respond. And the question is that Mr. Haveman voted to implement a state-based Obamacare exchange in Michigan and voted twice to expand Medicaid. So the question is, do you agree with Mr. Haveman's votes, and would you have voted the same way?
Obamacare, the health care reform bill, the Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, it is fraught with problems, and it is very concerning. There are some good provisions in the legislation that, because of consumer demand, will never be overturned, such as Medicare will always be a program that we have. Working at a hospital system, we all pay for the individuals who do not have insurance coverage and cannot afford to pay. That is a price that we all pay as taxpayers. So very hard decision that the legislature had to make, but it gets to patient care and patient access to make sure that our citizens and our communities are taken care of.
I would not have voted to expand Medicare, and I would not have voted to set up the exchange. I do not think it was a wise move. I am not in favor of Obamacare at all. The free market system is where we need to go with our insurance systems. Health savings accounts is where we need to be. By pushing it into this federal system, we've only made more problems and more costs.
I would not have voted to set up the exchange, and I would not have voted to expand Medicaid. We need to move in a free market direction. As I mentioned, my wife's a physician. She can tell you that you're going to spend, for every 10 minutes of patient care, you're going to spend an hour filling out forms, and Medicaid patient is not going to reduce. It's going to overwhelm the system. We need to move in a direct pay health savings account market-based solution. Tell the story at these forums. I talked to a physician, lives in this district, at great personal risk to himself, taking his practice direct pay, expects to lower cost to consumers by 40%. We need to encourage that kind of reform, not a failed government system.
I do not agree with Joe Haveman when he ended up voting that way. I would have voted the opposite, and that is one reason why I am running. I would like to repeal the Affordable Care Act and implement a more free market solutions when it comes to the health industry.
We begin with Bob. After the 2012 election, there was some discussion about changing how Michigan allocates our electoral votes. Some want to change it from winner takes all to two electoral votes per congressional district. If you are elected and this issue comes before you, how would you vote?
That's a very good question. I have not considered that one very much. I would probably stay with the current system that we have. I do not think I'd switch it.
As Bob said, I also have not thought that through in any great detail, so I could see there's probably arguments to go either way. I think it sounds intriguing. I would consider it.
I would actually be in favor of it, and the reason would be we all have a voice, a vote, and if the second district predominantly goes to the Republican candidate, then two electoral votes should probably go to the Republican candidate instead of the overall state going to the Democrat. I think if the overall state was to, be for the Democrat, you give them an additional ones for the two Senates. But I would be in favor of actually changing that.
I, too, have not given this particular issue much thought, but I would prefer the current system right now.
We start with Jeff. Some farmers in this area say they cannot find enough workers to harvest their crops. As a representative in this area, how would you try to help them?
Well, there isn't a whole lot you can do other than going out, I suppose, and doing the work for them. They need to advertise. We need to allow people to come to the state. To the extent we can allow open movement of people, they'll move to where they're needed. And the only way I'd see the government get involved is with some impediment so that workers couldn't move to that area, as long as they're willing to move there for the wage that's being offered. Getting the government out of the way and allowing the free movement of people to where their services are desired should solve that problem.
I think that would be a very hard thing from a government standpoint, because part of the problem is we're not willing to accept a lower pay from the farming community. And I'm not saying that the farmers want to lowball us on the wage, but a lot of us just don't want to do that type of work. And that's why you see a lot of Hispanic people getting into that. And the government has done a good job in getting them from neighboring states or even from neighboring countries. I would say besides trying to work with businesses to house them and get them connected, I think the issue is more of is within the individuals, the pride and humility kind of thing.
That is a tough question. I think from a government standpoint, what we can do is encourage that, you know, the workers. I think the agriculture industry has moved to providing increased wages and affordable and reasonable housing for the individuals. I mean, also, I would encourage some of our young workers to try some employment through agriculture. It is important for us as a state to ensure that our crops are viable and that we are not losing dollars.
That is a tough situation for government to get involved in, trying to put workers into any business group. That's really not what government should be doing. But I think one area we could maybe look to is our corrections department. We have a lot of community service and that kind of stuff out there, and I don't think farms are on the list of acceptable avenues that they could use that community service. We have work release programs in that through the prison, so maybe we could utilize some of that.
This question then is for Dave. The state Senate recently passed a bill that says the Department of Environmental Quality may not enforce the new stricter state and federal laws on wood-burning stove emissions or recreational fires. What is your position on this?
I would be in favor of what the Senate did. I mean, I think if the, you know, the state has its own right to be sovereign, given the 10th Amendment. And even though the federal level may be mandating certain things with a wood stove, you know, the state should be able to have the right to say, well, if someone wants to have a wood stove and burn it as whatever, however they're doing it, you know, they should do it. They shouldn't have to worry about the government getting in their life on that. So I'm glad that the Senate did that.
This is a particular bill that I have not been following closely. Typically, you know, federal law supersedes state law, and unfortunately in this case, it may not make sense and gets to the overregulation from both the state and federal government. Just generally speaking, it is, if it has just been passed by the Senate, that it is still in the process and up for discussion and review.
The EPA is an organization that is definitely out of bounds and has gone over their jurisdiction. It's something that needs to be reeled in, and I don't think that they need to be determining what kind of home heating product you use, whether it be corn or wood or gas or windmills or geothermal heating. So let's let people make their own decisions.
This question is for you, Daniela. Other than marijuana and immigration, what areas do you want more government regulation?
I don't think I want any more government regulation. The state of Michigan has undergone a process in reducing the number of regulations that are either ineffective or unnecessary, and that's something that I would continue. I think they have been able to reduce some thousands of regulations, and that is something that I would support continuing in the future.
As I said earlier, I'm not a fan of government regulation. I'd like to see a lot of it taken away. Some of it has been. There's a lot more out there that needs to be done. We need to go through more of it. So I'm not in favor of pushing any more government regulation.
I support less regulation, Back to the other question, I think that would be an appropriate thing for the state senate to do. The federal government is a government of enumerated and limited powers. The power to regulate wood-burning stoves is not one of them, so the state senate would be appropriate to protect the rights and liberties of the citizens of the state of Michigan.
I think we need to continue to get rid of some regulation and allow the businesses to thrive on their goodwill, on the services in which they're providing based on the amount of money that they have to, and when it comes to creating the services. And there's no reason why we can't let all businesses throughout the state and even in the country just to be able to compete and compete and compete without the government getting in there and taxing them and regulating.
How do you propose to maintain your personal and your constitutional constituents' values in the face of pressure from very active lobbying groups that currently influence the state legislature?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think lobbying groups, special interest groups, play an important role in the process. They should be there for research for the legislatures, and they should be there to provide information for them only. It's when you start accepting money, you start accepting donations, that's when you start getting pushed in their direction. That is one thing. That's why I don't really accept PAC funds. I'm pretty strong-willed and pretty free-spirited. I think I can hold my own against the lobbyists.
It's important to have a candidate with a strong idea of what the appropriate role of government should be. Also some ideas about what the United States Constitution means, what the Constitution of the State of Michigan means, how those documents should be interpreted, and beyond having that commitment, actually believing that we should follow those documents and having the will to follow through. Certainly all groups and all people have a right to petition their government for redress of grievances, but you need a legislature who has a principled understanding of what government should be, is willing to explain to you why he or she is going to make decisions that they would make. And such an individual will be able to stand up to inside pressure groups who are definitely going to want to seek an advantage through government favor.
I'm a firm believer in what the Bible says. It says that you let your yes be yes and your no, no. And it also says to be a man of character, a man of integrity. And if my constituents want me to vote one way, you better believe I'm voting that way. I think Bob is correct that lobbyists and interest groups should be there to educate and in terms of just letting us know what's going on, but then to start pushing votes and try to be the political machine and to get their own personal agenda, you're not going to get that with me. I'm sorry.
The voice of the constituents is the most important voice to listen to as a legislator, and it is naive to think that legislators do not interact with lobbyists. We oftentimes go to them for education, for understanding an issue, because when you are a legislator, you have many things coming at you all at once in an hour, in a minute, and you can't be a subject matter expert on every issue and need to rely on individuals who understand that particular issue that they're inquiring about.
This question is for Jeff. I thought you were going to add something.
No, I'm good.
Where do you stand on abortion, with it possibly being paid for by tax dollars?
I'm against abortion in all circumstances. Life begins at conception. One of the main purposes of government is to protect human life. Human life is precious and valuable. And I'm opposed to abortion.
I'm against abortion, and because life does begin at conception, we are created in the image of God, and we should be making sure that not a single penny of anybody's tax dollars should go to this horrible thing. In fact, I think the government should actually be a little more involved in terms of educating what risks are involved when someone has an abortion, instead of giving money to Planned Parenthood, who loves to advocate on behalf of having abortion. So I'm totally against it, and would not. I would make sure that no tax dollars go to it.
I am 100% pro-life, and am proud to have the endorsement of the Michigan Right to Life along with all of the other candidates, say constituents.
I, too, endorsed by Right to Life, and I am opposed to abortion. abortion is one of those federal issues that the states don't get to have as much say in it as what they really would like to have. But I think when it comes to funding, that's one area where we can have some say in it. And yeah, I would make sure that no taxpayer dollars are used for abortions.
Question 24, David. The Sentinel recently ran an editorial on the need for stricter oversight of charter schools, stating that public funds are used without enough oversight and without open board meetings. I know we've talked about charter before, but this is a little different. So the real question is, if there is no oversight, sufficient oversight for public funds, what is your opinion of that statement made by the Sentinel?
Well, I personally didn't read that article, so I'm not 100% sure on what's all being said and what may be advocated. But I think if the government is going to be given money, there should be sufficient oversight to make sure the money's being spent wisely. And if it's not going to, then the government shouldn't be giving that money away. Simple as that.
There is oversight in the current charter school system, and I support oversight and transparency when public dollars are in play.
I do support oversight of the charter school system, which there is quite a bit of oversight currently. I think actually they're receiving more scrutiny right now than some of the public schools are. Some of the bottom performing schools in the state right now are both public and a couple charter schools. The charter schools have been closed. The public schools are still open. So I think maybe we need to make sure that the public schools are scrutinized just as well.
I support oversight and transparency and generally open meetings when public dollars are involved.
This question is for you, Daniela, to begin.
Okay.
Michigan prisons move expensive for prisoners from neighboring states without releasing... evident felons. Any ideas for cost control? Michigan prisons... Oh, perhaps the question is move expensive per prisoner, the expensive prisoners to neighboring states without releasing felons. Any ideas? Let's talk about cost control for prisons.
Sure. I'm not sure I quite understand the question,
I apologize.
That's
I'm
okay.
Having difficulty reading
that's
this.
Okay. There can be, again, cost savings measures in making sure that there's oversight. Also privatizing services, which I know there has been an effort in the state of Michigan to do, can get at cost, and ensuring that there are, as Bob mentioned earlier, some training programs to make sure that individuals who are released have opportunity when they are released from prison so that we don't see them back in our correction system.
For controlling costs in prisons, I mean, a lot of it is the actual labor costs and the guards and the buildings themselves. So, I mean, technology, as it advances, we're going to be able to utilize more of that and hopefully reduce some of the costs. But the greatest savings that we can have in our correction systems is have less people there. So the more people we can get back out into society, get them educated, get them job trained, and get them to work, the less corrections money we're going to have to spend.
So I agree. Generally, the better the economy can be in Michigan and the smaller the prison population, the better. I also think we can look at maybe what we're doing with nonviolent offenders, that we're keeping them in the correction systems for too long, and that may tie back into sentencing guidelines, which we talked about earlier.
If I understood the question, it sounded like that we are receiving some inmates. If that's the case, I'd put a stop to that. You know, if they're going to go into our prison, they're within the state of Michigan. I would look into also reform when they're coming out, so that we can keep them out, get them into a job, and that would keep them from going in. I'd also consider this might be very small, but. They got cable, they got internet. Why are we providing stuff like that to them? And it may be a small cost. And also, I think you know, not a lot of people may be in agreement with this, but if the judges were to be, I guess, a little more stricter, it'll put some fear into the people, and it might consider them thinking twice. You know, not in all cases, but perhaps in some, and that would help also.
To the author of that question, I apologize, and if the question wasn't answered, please resubmit. Thank you. Question 26 goes to Bob first. There are a lot of college-age students in Holland who are struggling to get by. With that in mind, can you support the gas tax?
Okay, I'm not quite sure what the two go together, but I do not support the gas tax. I do not think we are utilizing the money that we are currently bringing in from the revenue of the gas tax. Only about 43% of that actually goes towards the roads. Anytime you raise a tax on the road or raise a tax on anything else, it's less money out of anyone's pocket, not alone a college student, but working families as well that are struggling too. So
I would not support a gas tax or raising the tax burden on the citizens of Michigan, whether of college age or whatever age they may be. I wouldn't support raising the tax burden on them. And the state should prioritize the monies that it has within its budget to take care of roads and other things that are a priority of the state.
I would not raise the gas tax or any other tax. In fact, I got a pledge that I signed, and if anyone wants to be a witness, I would not raise any taxes. Go for it. But as far as the students go, we should be looking into helping them to get a job and just make sure that they can get their education and continue to move on and continue to encourage them to move.
Not quite sure I fully understand the question or the correlation of the two. The gas tax, it is true that not all of the revenue that is generated goes for transportation. Some of it goes to education. If we are going to talk about roads and transportation, when and how to find and fix those, find money for and fix those problems, you know, I would support looking for existing revenues before looking for new revenues. However, when I go to the doors and when I talk to constituents, they are willing to pay a higher tax on number of taxes. Kind of pick your tax. There are many ideas on the table right now, but you know, you don't have to look that far, 30 miles away to Grand Rapids, where they took the problems into their own hands and came up with a solution and passed a solution that would address some of their road funding.
Question 27 starts with you, Jeff. The regulations on emissions from any source of power or heat production, coal, gas, wood burning, etc., are there to protect the health of citizens from the harmful effects of air pollution. Do you think that public health is worth protecting from air pollution?
The health of individuals is certainly worth protecting. I wouldn't want to harm anyone. And I think it comes back to personal property rights. If a power company or some emission company is causing that damage to an individual, then they should be liable for that. So you need to respect individual, all companies, and the problem comes with big companies like that will actually lobby government to get an exemption from the damage that they cause to individuals.
I think public health is very important, and we should look into making sure that all factories and other plants that are producing emissions are able to follow guidelines that would protect the health, but at the same time, we should also try to be fair on them to not regulate it to the point where they can't be in business, and because that will be a lot of tax losses, and even though it's very important for the health, you know, we also have to look at it from the economic standpoint of our needs, so that should force us to actually look into other diversities when it comes to energy.
The health of our citizens is very important to me and very important to all of us in this room, I would hope. You know, the question comes, what is the number of appropriate regulations that need to provide for the safety of our individuals and our citizens? And that is really the question, to ensure that there isn't too much regulation, but an appropriate amount to make sure that we are not harmed.
I think there's always kind of a little bit of a misnomer that for some reason Republicans breathe different air than everyone else does. We all breathe the same air. We all want good health. We all have children. We all have families. We want the environment to be protected. We want people to be healthy. We're not out to try and hurt anybody, but at the same point, we're trying to make sure that everyone has the available and free flow of energy that they need. So I think at that point, we have to balance both what regulations actually protect us and what are actually hurting us and basically holding the state back from growing.
And our last question of the evening is this. Michigan relaxed its fireworks laws in 2011. Since then, there have been many complaints about noisy neighborhood fireworks. Do you think 30 days per year for fireworks are too many? Do you think noisy fireworks should be outlawed?
I've actually been asked a similar question while going door to door. And my response to this audience would be the same as to them. If someone wants to go out and have some fun, I know it's going to be burdensome on some people. But I think the government is okay. I mean, now if the majority of the constituents would want me to vote to lower that, then yeah, I'd be willing to do that. But I think if someone wants out and have a great time and celebrate our independence, you know, let them have it. 30 days out of 365. I know my wife doesn't like it, but.
I guess my response to that right now, the little sleep that I am getting, I can sleep through just about anything. But 30 days, you know, out of 365 days doesn't seem like a lot, but 30 days in a consistent fashion could be a bit excessive. I'm not well-versed in this particular subject and would obviously listen to the constituents in the district and their voice on this one.
I think as far as this issue goes, it needs to go back to the local levels to control ordinances and to control noises at that. Let them set this. As far as the state, there's a lot of rural communities where it's not a big deal. It's in the cities and the neighborhoods that we seem to have the issues. So I think this should really go back to a local level issue.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's definitely something people mentioned. I have heard about the noisy fireworks. And when I lived in town with younger children than I even have now, it could be an issue personally for me as well. But generally, I think that should be determined at the local level. I don't know that the state government needs to get involved with what's too loud, and I think a lot of it depends on where you're at.
As indicated, the audience has provided us with 28 questions. We thank you very much. And now each candidate will have 2 minutes for closing statements. So we begin again with Daniela.
Sure. Well, again, thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening, and thank you for the 28 questions. This is a first. you know, I'll go back to what my priorities are for when I am in the legislature, and the number one, two, and three priority is the economy for me. We can get to the skills gap, that issue that we have through quality education and access for all students, providing career and vocational training so that students are able to enter the workforce, and collaborating as we already do here in Ottawa County and sharing those best practices across the state in terms of workforce initiatives of private and public sectors. What I will say is that I am the most qualified and experienced candidate in this race, in that I have worked in public policy for over a decade. 6 years is not a lot of time to be able to affect great change or policies at the state level, and you really need someone who understands the environment, understands the legislative process to be your next state representative. I am not the only one who believes that I am the most qualified, but there are many and numerous individuals in our community who have supported me and many community organizations who have done so as well. So I am a fiscal conservative with a heart for our community, and I ask for your vote on August 5th.
I think you've heard a lot of wide ideas tonight, a lot of varying ideas, and you've got four people that have a lot of different experiences. None of us are experienced at being a state legislature. That job is Joe Hobman's, and he's the only one that's experienced, and he's term limited out. So now you have to pick someone here who you think is going to do the best job. I have the business and leadership experience that I think is what we need right now in Lansing. We need someone who's going to go there and is going to try and put some of this partisan divide aside, who is going to start moving forward with the state. We're going to have to come together on issues that we agree. I think we all want to watch control our spending because that's near and dear to everybody's heart. We want to improve our educational system. That's also near and dear to everyone's heart because our kids are the future of this state. We want to make sure that our kids are educated and that they stay here, that they're not forced to go somewhere else and find a job. So we have to improve the business climate here. We also have to improve the regulations in the system and the government so that we can continue to improve, so that we can draw businesses here, and so that kids can prosper. So I think in closing tonight, I really want to thank everyone for coming out. I encourage you to vote for me on August 5th. I am not a career politician. I am not interested in really being a politician. I am running because I want to make a difference. When the term is up, I will go back to my career. I don't know if everybody else up here will say that too, but that's my pledge. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Hobman. I'm asking for your vote on August 5th. I'm running because I'm committed to openness and transparency in government. There's a sheet out there. Feel free to take it. There's a phone number on there. Call me. Interact with me at any time. I also want to make Michigan a freer and more prosperous place. We want to respect the rule of law so that Michigan can do better for all of us and for our children. I'm not running to represent powerful, connected people or big corporations or anything like that. I'm running to bring the voice of the real people of this district to Lansing. To that end, I've set forth what I believe. You can take a look at the website. I've been very clear about my positions and the philosophy that will underlie my decision-making. And I solicit you to interact with me about that. I very much enjoy that. But I'm running to bring those principles and your voice and values to Lansing. So I ask for your vote on August 5th.
Thank you for having us here, and I think the 9th District has the opportunity to be able to pick a unique person. Like Bob said, we all have our different experiences, and I have experience in leadership by leading the Bible study in college, by leading the adult Sunday school at church and being the youngest for youth group, and also for being on some other committees for classes of Zealand. Also, just having the heart to serve as well. Getting my hands dirty as far as going to India, Florida, Louisiana, and Illinois. And just not only through church, but also through the Republican Party, through volunteering as a precinct delegate, and also just giving my time for Youth for Christ as well. So I also have the heart for a community to serve, to be a public servant. That is why I went door-to-door asking for you to get me on the ballot. I think that makes me the people's choice. If you think about the name of my website, it's David Kroll for the people. When you look at my flyer, it's of the people for the people. And one thing that I really would like to achieve, not necessarily in Lansing when it comes to the budget, education, repealing Obamacare and replacing Common Core, but that is to connect with the people, because I believe there is a big disconnect with the people and the politician. And that is what I would like to try to reestablish. That is why I'm the only one that has pledged to have a town hall meeting once a month, and also to meet with the local representatives of councils at least a couple times a year, and willing to just continue to serve you and you only.
Thank you. On behalf of League, I really want to thank each of you. You've fielded a large variety of questions this evening and done it very ably. And so we thank you for your willingness to participate and to be transparent.
Thank you so much, Jan. And thank you all for coming. And thank you, folks, for putting up with so many questions. That was very good. I'd like to remind you that this forum will be available on Comcast and AT&T on the appropriate channels that you are able to get at your residence. And it will also be available online on Vimeo. If you go to lwvholland.org, and then also remind you about vote411.org, which is a chance to look at your ballot for all of the races in the state of Michigan and all of the proposals that will be on the ballot for your particular street address. And thank you all for coming, and we hope that you've gained some insight into the candidates for the 90th District on the Republican ballot. They might have materials out in the hall. You're welcome to take materials as you leave. And right at the door, Ellen Leick has the information about where the program is available in the video media. Pass it along to your friends who weren't able to come tonight. This is good information to share with your friends and neighbors. Also, we have materials about the League of Women Voters. And if you're interested in joining or in contributing to our missions, the League of Women Voters Education Fund is a 501c3 organization, and all donations are tax deductible. Since this is an election year, we will be producing more forums in Allegan and Ottawa counties. We have one next week in Allegan County, and we will have another one in Ottawa County before the end of July. And we also support the Voters Guide Vote 411 for local elections in August, and we will again be doing forums and Vote 411 for November. So your support can help us defray the costs involved in producing any print voters' guides and expenses that are incurred for the forums. So thank you once again. Please give our participants a big round of applause, and everybody drive safely.